I'm honored to be here at this terrific conference. Basically, what I want to talk about today is the evolution of the SPIA market, in Canada and the United States from the point of view of our point of view, basically a business that focuses on technology. We're an exchange. And the three defining differences that I want to talk about are the market size. United States is bigger than Canada. History of retirement legislation and government and government impact. But before I do, I want to bring some context to this and get into something that is getting a fair amount of press in United States, much less so in Canada, and that's retirement income planning. And essentially what we try to do with retirement income planning is we divide or we analyze the income needs and divide it into expenses that are essential versus those that are discretionary. Why do we do this? Well, avoid running out of money is one thing. If by buying the appropriate insurance product, a life annuity, avoid underspending because you know you won't run out of money or you won't dip below your essential needs. And finally, to get a better return, because if your essential expenses are covered, then the client can feel more comfortable taking a more aggressive approach on the discretionary expenses. So basically, how should the client invest? With his essential expenses, you buy a life annuity. The discretionary expenses, free from the worry of running out of money, you can be more aggressive. Big hurdle here is that with the essential expenses, you have to get the client to understand that this money is for the annuitant, it's not for the kids. After death, there is no need for the annuitant to have any more money. This bucket is for the children, or for the annuitant, not for the kids. So this is pretty compelling stuff here. We have by buying an annuity, you have a pretty compelling sales tool. You're avoiding running out of money, you're providing a comfort level, and you're getting a better return. You would think that that this would be an easy sale, and the question is it? And the answer is not really. The number one concern of retirees based on LIMRA is that they'll outlive their income. 55%, based on the same study, said they are interested in the concept, but only 1 or 2% annuitize. If you look at financial planning that's done today, it's generally done to life expectancy, but as we all know, 50% live beyond life expectancy. Key concerns for retirees are longevity and inflation, and variable payout annuities address that better than any other product. Sales are terrible in both Canada and United States, certainly a lot worse in Canada. 70% of retirees plan to fund their retirement by working, but in reality only 30% manage to because of health and demand concerns. We live in a society that prefers to hire younger people. Most people feel they live longer than average, but most people greatly underestimate how long they'll live. My grandfather lived to age 80. Does that mean I will? Well, chances are I'll live longer than that. So what about Canada? I mean, a recent HSBC study said Canadians are better prepared for retirement than any other country in the world. we buy proportionately more SPIAs than Americans do. Are we better at retirement income planning? And the answer is, after years of pushing retirement income, most Canadian payout annuities, life annuities, are sold for estate planning. They're not sold for retirement income. And that's looking at a CANIC study where what we did is we followed up with estate planning. The way you use annuities for estate planning is you buy an annuity to fund a life insurance product, and therefore you get the benefit of life insurance, of the non-tax on the life insurance, but you're getting around the minimal tax requirement by buying an annuity. And when we asked our clients what portion of annuities are sold for that purpose, what we find is that non-registered prescribed annuities are sold primarily for insured annuities. From CANIC's statistics, that's 59% of the annuity quotes that are done. 13% are sold for insured annuities using corporate funds, in other words, richer people, essentially, and only 28% are used for specifically retirement. Now, there should be a certain amount of, take these numbers with a grain of salt, because a large portion of the derivation of these numbers comes from asking our clients what they feel the portion of annuities sold are used for, and these are the answers, but there is no other way of getting at this sort of information. So moving along, who is CANIC? A lot of people here are probably not familiar with us. Essentially, what we do is provide an exchange for the SPIA market. The way we work is that each of the insurance carriers provide us with their method of calculating SPIAs. We analyze the code and separate into component parts. And the idea here is, while every single SPIA has every company has a unique method of calculating SPIAs, if broken down into component parts, the components are not all that different. There aren't that many ways of determining an amount of time between two different dates and that sort of thing. And so what we do is we analyze the code that they provide, separate it into component parts, and reproduce the algorithm based on pre-written subroutines. We test and prove the accuracy and so on. And as a result, what we end up with is a single architecture, a single database with lots of shared code, where that is used for the Canadian SPIA system, the US SPIA system, and as well as ASP, application service provider, solutions for individual insurance carriers that find it less expensive to use CANIC to illustrate their SPIA products than develop their own. Yep. Oh, sorry. A SPIA is a single premium immediate annuity, a life annuity. So the differences between the Canadian life annuity market and the U.S. life annuity market on the CANIC system are market-driven. They're not technology-driven, because they're basically using the same platform. What we've found is, what we've decided is, based on previous comments, as well as lots of comments hear about from previous speakers that there is a need for education, and so we've recently increased our mandate to include education. And specifically, what we're going to be providing in the near future is presentation material that the advisor can provide the client that provides an explanation of the suggested product, the life annuity. Then one of the things that generally comes up is, well, what about yield? Is this a good investment for me? And from a life annuity is a little bit different than most products on the basis of yield because you don't know what the internal rate of return on the life annuity is until you die, and we don't know how long you're going to die, how long you're going to live. So what we do, or what we will be doing, is providing a graph, assuming that you die at a particular age, this is the internal rate of return. And the next component we'll be providing is an ILY, which is similar work that Moshe and IFID have been doing with us. And what that does is it combines the yield with the individual mortality credits to come up with one number that essentially says, should I wait to buy a life annuity or should I buy one now? Finally, the last component that we're going to provide is a custom simulation that basically it tries to answer the question, well, the reason why I'm buying a life annuity is to reduce the probability of ruin. Does it work? And so do a simulation before and a simulation after and see how that has an impact on the probability of ruin. So getting back to implied longevity yield, this is some really good research that IFID has done. And what it is starting with the assumption that I, the annuitant, want a lifetime annuity, have two choices. You can take plan A, which is I buy a life annuity now, or you can buy an annuity later, and in the meantime buy another investment, a systematic withdrawal, that pays the same monthly benefit as the annuity and leaves me enough money at the end of the systematic withdrawal period, at the end of the waiting period, to buy a life annuity later when it's cheaper. So the yield that exactly provides the monthly payments and leaves me enough money to buy the annuity later is the ILY. Back to my main topic, the differences between the Canadian and U.S. markets. Number one is market sizes. And that has a very big impact on the channels that are used. The number two is the history of retirement legislation. When the RRSP legislation was introduced versus the IRA legislation, and then government planning. I'm going to go over each of these separately. So the number one difference that I want to talk about is market size. And in Canada, most producers or advisors can pretty well buy from anyone. If an advisor doesn't have a direct relationship with the insurance company, they can set one up very quickly, or they can make an arrangement with a friend who does have a relationship. In the U.S., shelf space is a key driver for business. So as a result, you have a person typically that decides, should this insurance carrier be on the shelf for my distribution company as a broker-dealer or manager, general agent or whatever. And as a result, that person is in a sense, the client of the carrier. Carriers innovate to be on the seller's shelf so that they can, because it's a driver of what's going on here. Some of the innovations, as an example, are variable pay annuities, which came a whole lot sooner in the United States than it did in Canada. In the United States, it's a good market for a small number of carriers. Most carriers are doing terribly in it. One of the key differences here, though, is that in order for a product to be successful, you have to pay for enough of the research and development costs. And that's fairly fixed, whether you're in Canada or United States. If you're selling to a smaller market, you need a higher portion of sales to generate a successful product. And so, for example, in the variable pay annuity market in the United States is currently about $250 million. Tiny, divide that by 10, and a $25 million market is basically an impossible market to successfully reach. Other innovations that we're seeing in the United States are long deferred pay annuities, which are not really available in Canada. I think Garth is going to talk about that. And combination of accumulation and pay annuities from GE. The point here is that it's easier to innovate in a larger market, but on the other hand, the Canadian SPIA market developed sooner, and the reason why it developed sooner is because when retirement income legislation was introduced, which in Canada was in the late 50s. Add 25 years to get the population and investments used to the idea of saving for retirement, and you end up in the early 80s, when the interest rate environment in the early 80s was a very high interest rate. In fact, we had stagflation, and annuities peaked with insurance companies using as high as 18% for 15 years and 9% thereafter. I mean, every person in this room would love to buy an investment like that today. But the point is that it was excellent conditions to buy a life annuity, and therefore excellent conditions to establish an exchange. In the United States, IRA legislation, which was the first legislation to address saving for retirement, was introduced in the early 70s. Add 25 years and we end up in the mid-90s, where we have a low interest rate environment, a booming market, and essentially poor conditions to establish a life annuity exchange, or indeed to buy a life annuity. As a result of the demand here, Canex was the second Canadian company to introduce information about life annuities. But 15 years later, Canex was the first company to introduce information on life annuities in the United States. Now, to establish a new technology, you need a hook. You need a significant improvement over current methods, because people tend to not want to change. If you don't give them a compelling reason to change, they'll continue to use their current method. In Canada, as an example, distributed SPIA software, in other words, PC software that runs on the agent's platform, never really got established. We didn't have the bells and whistles that you had in the United States. On the other hand, And the reason for that is that an exchange was established, and it was a whole lot easier for agents to use the Kanak system than to run a whole lot of PC software. It's not to say that PC software didn't exist. It did. There wasn't the level of work put into PC software that there was in the United States. On the other hand, and then what happens is because we didn't put that effort into PC software, when a better solution came along, web-based software, there's more a quicker trend in Canada towards web-based solutions. So you're seeing more companies in Canada that are web-based versus in the United States. And again, that has to do with providing a hook to change people's habits. On the other hand, the Kanak system is better in the United States than it is in Canada, even though it uses the same software, and that is because in the United States, all companies guarantee what is on Kanak, versus in Canada, we've never been able to convert all companies. We have most, but not all companies, guaranteeing the accuracy of the system. And in addition, in the United States, there's an illustration provided that is easier to give to the client than what we do in Canada. It's available to the broker. However, the numbers that are generated on Kanak are guaranteed by the carrier. In other words, in both countries, in the States, all 100% of companies guarantee Kanak's accuracy. In Canada, about 75% guarantee. Better. Specific to the company, yeah. So looking at what at the state of the art in Canada, maybe I should move on. So, looking at why we succeeded in Canada, and the main driver behind why we succeeded in Canada were essentially that rate books were physically too heavy. The method that was used in 1981, or in the early 80s when we got established, was advisors would have a book, like a telephone book size, rate book for every single insurance company that it wanted to quote, and it was a whole lot easier to carry a thermal printer. It's a technology question. Insurance carrier in phone-in services, which were the alternative, were unresponsive. It took us 3 days to get a quote, and since quotes were only guaranteed for 24 hours, you couldn't do a market survey. The other reasons were essentially patience and a self-improving architecture. As insurance companies cooperated, the accuracy increased because we were estimating insurance companies' rates for those that were not cooperating. Whereas in the United States, we're succeeding, and it's hard to say that we're a success yet in the United States because we're not ubiquitous. We're nowhere near ubiquitous yet. But the reason why we're succeeding is very different. We're succeeding because information is no longer hidden. In the early 80s, insurance companies could hide behind the fact that that, you know, or could pretend that the market, that people were not shopping around. In they can't do that anymore. Speed is now essential. An advisor needs to get this done as quickly as possible. Canix is a third party, and that is very important. And we have the same patience and self-improving network that is necessary. So what's the impact of an exchange? And this is something that is being studied by IFID. And some of the impacts of an exchange are that it reduces expenses to carriers. And the way it does that is it reduces the cost of providing proprietary illustrations, because they become less important, because the advisor uses a central exchange to get the illustration. And there's a reduced need to advertise your competitiveness, because it's completely obvious that you're competitive if you show up high on a survey. It also increases transparency, and resulting in more competition between carriers. And frankly, we've been criticized for that. But it provides third-party comparisons to consumers, and therefore it gets the consumer a little bit more comfortable with annuities and that they're not being ripped off. It also shifts costs to distributors, and the reason why it does that is because in proprietary software, the carrier pays 100% of the fee, versus an exchange model where basically everyone pays, and so the distributor pays a large portion of the cost of the exchange. But it does reduce the distributor's fee, because his time is worth some money.
And her time too.
And her time too, yeah. It reduces the need for PC-based illustrations, and as a result, with PC-based illustration systems, it's very difficult to change your interest rates quickly. And with a central-based system, like an exchange, you reduce your mismatch risk, because the interest rate market changes, you can respond very quickly. And as a result of that, at least partially as a result of that, Canadian carriers change three times as quickly as American carriers. On average, Canadian carriers change their interest rates 56 times a year, versus on average, American carriers change 18 times a year. As I mentioned, those being studied by IFID. But what's happening in the market today is driven by U.S. needs. In the United States, you see articles about deaccumulation, in other words, what you should do with your retirement savings. In Canada, those articles are basically non-existent, but the companies that are driving some of these trends are active in both of these markets. The Ibbotson, Ernst & Young, other financial planning software vendors are often the same companies, in addition to Canex, And so what we're seeing is these companies are responding to the markets where the demand is, in other words, in the United States. Another big impact is government planning. This is number three. In Canada, we have balanced budgets, and our government pension plan is fully funded, versus the United States, where spending is essentially out of control, and Social Security is underfunded. The impact of this is, well, I believe the U.S. administration looks at other countries and says, what about other countries where where the demographic curve is farther along than we are. And if you look at other countries where that have other underfunded government pension plans with a more advanced demographic curve, like Italy and France, where they've tried to rein in government pension costs, you have general strikes and the government immediately backed down and hasn't been mentioned since. Then you have excessive costs in Germany and Japan of government pension plans. In Germany, it's something like 25% of the budget for a government pension, to fund government pensions. So in the United States, the response is to say, well, there's got to be individual responsibility, and so we're seeing lots of new incentives for saving or for spias. An example of where government has a direct impact is the state tax legislation. In the United States, there are plans to eliminate estate tax in 2010, versus in Canada, there's no plans. As a result, insured annuities, which essentially reduces government revenue, is a moot point, a moot issue in the United States, because the issue disappears in 5 years, versus in Canada, where it is a real concern. So in summary, the markets are different. The underlying technology to serve each of the markets are the same, or very similar. The U.S. has a higher perceived need for life annuities, but Canadians should not be complacent because our corporate pension plans and our individual pension plans are not really in better shape than the U.S. market. However, the U.S. market will be more dynamic because it's being addressed. And so Canadians should be studying what's going on in the U.S. for market directions and trends. And thanks.
With the audience's permission, we're going to reserve questions until the end of the two or three presentations. And the next speaker for this afternoon is Garth Bernard. Garth Bernard is the Vice President of Annuity Product Management at MetLife, and he is responsible for both the and general account annuities. He was Vice President of Product Development at Keyport Life, and he was Chief Actuary at ReliaStar. So he has a tremendous amount of experience. He worked at Transamerica. So he will tell us a little bit more about product innovation in this industry. So please join me in welcoming Garth.
Thanks, Moshe. Whoops, I don't need that. It's always great to be here in Toronto. Always feels like I'm coming home. I'm a former graduate of the University of Toronto, as well as the University of Waterloo. So this is always a nice event for me to be in Toronto. Try to visit as much as I can. What I'm going to try to do is I'm going to be as non-technical as possible. My presentation is going to look at a case study of how we take concepts to market. And there's no technical details in here. We're past we're past the point of the academic analysis and validating concepts. Now we're trying to look at, can we actually make this successful in the marketplace? So one of the things we're going to look at is, where do ideas come from? And in this particular example, we're going to look at a long-deferred immediate annuity. It's referred to by various names, including longevity annuities and so on. In terms of some of the practical considerations, we'll go through the internal sale. What does it take to be successful with the idea internally within the company? And then you make the decision to build something. If you build it, will people want to buy it? And then some of the practical challenges of actually executing. And finally, we'll look at the issue of distribution, okay? And in the retail market in particular, companies don't necessarily take their products directly to consumers. They use distributors. So let's look at where this particular idea came from. It's not a new idea, but in terms of the practical application of this idea, one of the things that we've observed in the U.S. market is that defined benefit plans are becoming extinct, and instead 401k plans, where the onus is on the participant to save for retirement on their own, and you know, that's dominating the market. That's the 401k is equivalent to your RRSP. Now, when you look at the defined contribution plans, so the 401k plans, in terms of retirement savings or generating income for retirement, there's still some significant inadequacy. For example, a participant can't tell how much a dollar that they save today is going to generate in future income. They can only estimate it. Secondly, because there is no income orientation, very few 401k participants actually take their savings in the form of an annuity for their lifetimes. And in fact, a quarter of eligible participants don't even participate. So these are certainly not, you know, the panacea that is hoped for, at least in the U.S. context, of retirement savings. One of the things that we try to do, I'd suggest that just about everyone that has or sponsors a 401k plan is to look at, you know, the education of the participants towards, you know, retirement income. Now, one of the things that one of the shortcomings, as I mentioned earlier, is that the participants don't have a way to see their future income. So they can't tell whether the amounts that they've saved today relative to their income goals are adequate, inadequate, or what have you. And in fact, the risks that are associated with that savings program aren't very clear to them. So this is where product innovation, this particular innovation, comes in. What we're trying to do is directly bridge the gap between a dollar that's paid today, contribution today, and income in the future. So while the 401k programs can bring the consumers to the water, okay, so you give them the allowance or the accommodation to save for retirement, will they actually utilize it? And if they utilize it, will they generate income that lasts for their lifetime? In other words, are they taking care of the longevity risk? So here's a very brief description of how this product works, and I'll put a little bit of an illustration up in a second. But basically, it's a fixed deferred income annuity. Fixed means that it's not participating in the market, guarantees a future income, and basically, here are the highlights. A contribution today is going to buy a guaranteed amount of income tomorrow based on today's economic environment. The income in this particular product that we've created at MetLife, the client can turn it on anywhere from age 50 to 85 at their choice after at least a two-year wait. There's a range of income choices in terms of payouts, life annuities that they can take. For example, you know, they can take a life annuity based only on their life contingency. They can take a life annuity that's guaranteed for a period of time and then continues based on whether they're alive or not, et cetera. There is a death benefit, which is equal to a return of the premiums at 3% if they have not been able to turn the income capability or the income feature on. So in other words, they can leave something for their beneficiaries. And there is a... Correct. If you die before, you can turn the income on, give you the money back with 3%. There is a commuted value or liquidity where after the income starts, so the client says or the participant says, I'd like to start my income. I'm age 65 or 75 or whatever age they choose to turn it on. Within 60 days of starting the income, we allow them to take a portion of the future value or the value of their future payments to meet any unexpected liquidity needs that they may have had.
Can you decide the start date when you buy it, or you can start
You don't have to decide a thing until you're ready to turn the income on. So there are some practical aspects or implications of that, and we'll get to some of those in a second. This is just a quick example of how it works. This is the standard version. We actually have two versions. This is what I just described, and in this case, a $10,000 premium paid at age 65 right there will generate $126 a month. But if they waited until 85 to turn it on, that same $10,000 at age 65 will generate $331 a month. There's a second version of this, which we call the retirement income insurance version. And in this case, the difference, there's just one simple difference. Well, actually a couple. But the key difference is that there's no death benefit. Okay? So when you put the money in, the only thing that you can get is income. Okay? If you die before you can take the income, you get nothing. The other practical issue is that we allowed the or disallowed the participant from taking their income at any other date but age 85. So we wanted to defer that start date out as far as possible. And you can see you get a lot more leverage here, $603 a month starting at age 85, but in the standard version was $331 a month.
Oh, I understand that. You get $10,065.
Right.
You only start at 85, and you die at 65, you get nothing back.
That's in the second version. In this version, it's very flexible. Okay, you can start at 75. You can start any time after 2 years have elapsed, provided that you're over age 50, and any time between there and 85. In the second version, you can only start at 85, and there's no death benefit.
That's what I mean. That one, you get 10,000, and it's a risk. If you die before 85, you've lost.
Exactly. So actually, the first time I showed this to a group of agents, when I got to this second slide, they all were cracking up in the aisles. I was like, what are you laughing at? Right, they said, well, why would anybody buy this? And I'll show you why in a second. This is a quick summary of how it works. Those are the two versions. As you can see, we call the first one, the flexible one, the personal income builder. For $30,000 at age 65, you can generate $1,000 a month of retirement income for life at age 85, and the retirement income insurance version, that only costs $16,582. Okay, so that's the concept, very simply put. Now, in order to take something to market, okay, question is, you know, how is it going to work internally? You got to have the internal buy-in. Now, of course, internally, there's dozens of ideas that are coming up at any given time. A lot of ideas never see the light of day because they're either stupid ideas that would never make sense anyway, just kidding, or they could be ideas that don't have, you know, the sponsorship. No one's really taken a hold of it and running with it. Okay, so one of the things we've found, in fact, any organization, I'm sure will say the same thing, is that not only do you have to have significant resources to get behind ideas, you have to have a lot of internal alignment. The systems folks have to be on board, the finance folks have to be on board, etc. You also have to have an executive sponsor who stands behind that idea and pushes it forward in the organization. That's basically the role of the executive sponsors, to get this thing, you know, the internal buy-in and support that it needs, to get the budget for the ideas so that it can be executed. So that brings us to the question, okay, let's assume that, you know, the internal sale has been made, there's a sponsor, everybody's behind the idea. If you build it, will they come? It's always an interesting question, and this is where market research comes in. I'm not a proponent of market research myself. That's my own personal bias, because I think companies spend a lot of time and money seeking sufficient proof. They want to hear that somebody needs this, okay? But I would suggest that we need to understand whether the market wants it, and it doesn't matter whether you go ask, you know, 100 people or a dozen people, all the various market research workshops, people tell you what you want to hear. There's no vested interest in them, you know, really saying the truth. Well, it's not necessarily that they're not telling the truth. There's nothing for them to lose by saying whatever they have to say. Okay, so my conclusion is that the market research is a crapshoot. What you have to have is, you know, a desire to create the future. If you create the future, people will come. Okay? For example, nobody asked, you know, who was it that created the first cell phone? Okay? Nobody asked, you know, that company to create cell phones. I don't think anybody ever conceived that they wanted that. But they exist. So let's talk about some of the practical challenges. I'm going to fly through some of these slides. I'll just highlight a couple of the practical issues of execution. Regulatory approvals. In this case, there was no SEC approval needed, but we had to go to the states. When you're going to show someone a potential client, if your representative, broker, agent sits down with a client to advise them on their retirement income, you know, how are they going to show them the concept? Okay. Then compliance and suitability. Is this, you know, it's not necessarily right for everyone. How do you ensure that only the right sales are being made, that people that buy this really needed it? Okay, and it's not just a broker or a representative that was trying to push a sale on someone. And then tax laws and regulations always have to be considered. And then, you know, one of the, I guess, it's almost like a ball and chain around you is your administrative systems. How flexible are they in terms of being able to administer new concepts, new ideas, get that automated so you can, you know, cost effectively be in the marketplace? So let's look at some of the issues, and again, I'm not going to go through every single bullet, but in terms of regulatory approvals, this slide has actually nothing to do with the National Football League, although you'll see NFL on there. That's the non-forfeiture laws in the U.S. Basically, when you develop annuity products, you have to satisfy the non-forfeiture laws. Non-forfeiture simply means that there is a minimum requirement for the amount of value that needs to be generated for the client given a certain amount of premium. So that had to be looked at, and there are 51 different states, each of which supposedly looks at the same underlying conceptual framework for non-forfeiture, but some of them may interpret stuff differently. For example, one state, New York, said, actually, we don't think the non-forfeiture law applies to this concept. Just about everybody, every other state did, and certain features in the contracts, like the absence of a cash value, created some issues for some of the state regulators. But the product was approved in so far 40 states, and we believe that we're going to get the other 10. Let's talk a little bit about product illustrations. So agent sits down with the client, says, you know, let me show you a way to generate significant retirement income in the future with limited dollars. You know, here's the product brochure. Now they got to talk about, well, if I gave you the $10,000, how much income would I get? So the agent has to have something readily available to demonstrate to the client, or to any given client, what value they'll get out of the product. So that's called a quote tool. But there are some issues around quote tools. For example, in fact, this came up, I think somebody asked the question a little earlier of Lowell. Are your SPIA rates guaranteed? Well, here's why this is an issue. Let's say, you know, I sat down to show you this illustration. You went off to discuss it with your family. You come back a week later to the agent. You said, you know what, I'd like to buy that. If at that point the agent said to you, well, guess what, the price changed, you'll feel like you've been cheated a little bit. You know, like, wait a minute, I went off, I looked at this, I really like this price. Now it got a little bit more expensive. So what we have to do is we have to have what we call quote locks. Okay, so that's just an example of an issue. I'm not going to go through every single one of them. Compliance and suitability. This is where the lawyers get involved, and we want to ensure that every sale is suitable for every client that buys any product that we sell. So what we do is we come up with suitability guidelines. I'll give you a simple example. Let's say the client has shown an illustration of $10,000, and that's going to generate, in that case, it was $100 a month. They said, I'll turn this on at $75, and that's what I'll get. I'll get $100 a month. Well, was that a suitable sale? It could be, but then again, it may not be. Let's say that client only had $15,000 to their net worth. You're spending, what is that, two-thirds of your net worth on this product? Is that a good use of your net worth? Maybe not. So we have constraints on how much of their net worth people can spend on the product. The same example, Let's say it was, you know, half of someone's net worth or a quarter of their net worth, and it's generating $100 a month more income. Well, if they already had a pension plan, let's say, that was generating $1,000 a month, is that increment enough value added to that client? We sell through a variety of distribution channels. We sell through our captive distribution, our own agents, agencies that we own, broker-dealers, independent distribution. We sell through banks, broker-dealers, wirehouses. At the end of the day, the company, the carrier, does have that responsibility. Now, some may, you know, relegate the responsibility and think that they don't have liability, but they do. So, I mean, part of this is, you know, the training of the agents and what have you. How much time do I have, Moshe? 10? Okay. Tax laws and regulations. This was an interesting one. You know, first question is it permissible under the law? Okay. Now, it was pretty clear that it was, but there were some issues that came up in the context of qualified dollars. For example, in 401k plans, IRAs, and what have you, there's a requirement under the U.S. tax law that a minimum amount of value needs to be distributed when the client turns age 70 and a half. Okay? Now, in this particular concept, for example, the retirement income insurance version where the income doesn't start until 85 and there's no cash value, the client gets to 70, let's say they're in a qualified plan, the IRS says, you have to take some value out of that contract, or that client has to take some, you know, implied value out of the contract. They got to distribute it from somewhere of their qualified funds. Well, A, how do you come up with that implied value? B, is it going to make sense to the customer? You know, and so on. It becomes a very significant practical issue. And so what we decided to do was we do not offer the retirement income insurance version to qualified participants. We only offer the very flexible version where the income can start at any time. And in that case, we require that the income start no later than age 70 and a half. Okay, so again, just a very simple nuance based on the practical issues that you face when you go to actually put it into the marketplace. Administrative systems, it's an interesting, you know, always an interesting aspect. You know, you asked the question a little earlier, you know, at what age do they have to tell you when they buy the contract, when do they want to start the income? And we wanted to make it as flexible as possible. So we said, you don't have to tell us a thing, okay? You buy it, you decide when you want to turn the income on. So, of course, the natural question from the customer is going to be, well, if I turn it on at 55, how much income am I going to get? If I turn it on at 75, how much income am I going to get? Or 74, or 72, or whatever age that you give them the flexibility to choose. So from an administrative standpoint, what that meant was that we actually had to build the mainframe program to store the guaranteed income at every possible age that they could elect to turn on the income. So that was an interesting, again, consideration. We had to build the systems to store these values. Now, as went to look at it, you know, from age 50 to 85, that's, I think, 36 numbers that you have to store. System folks said that's going to be massively expensive, okay, for some reason. It's a mainframe box, a lot of programming, a lot of looking up, a lot of numbers to be stored for every single client. So what we decided to do was store only quinquennial ages and then interpolate between them. You know, so very simple things like that, but it takes a lot of thought process, a lot of thinking through the issues, a lot of ideas come into play during these considerations, and a lot of innovation, as I see it, is necessary at each stage of the execution process. So to wrap it up, Let's talk about what happens when the product is now in the market. So now we've figured out how to execute. We've put all the systems in place, all the legal context in place. Clients out there, or the products out there in the marketplace, you know, who's going to buy this? Well, that's not even the question. The question is, who's going to sell it? And you have to get the agents to buy in. How do you get salespeople to buy in? Well, you have to make it easy for them to do business, okay? It's got to be a very simple story. It's got to be a simple story for them to understand. It cannot take 30 minutes to explain. It's got to take, you know, they got 30 seconds. You know, think about it. Salesperson comes in to you and, you know, you want them out of here. So they got to say something within the first maybe 30 seconds. Yeah, to draw you in. And what we found we had to do was, you know, create some stories and some tools. And I said earlier that I almost got laughed out of the room when I showed the concept. People were literally on the floor pointing. And I said, what are you laughing at? So I said, well, hold on. You know, give me a little second here, and I'll show you why you want to buy this. And here's an example. Real quick, you may not be able to read this, but basically this is a piece that we created that's it shows a client how likely they are to run out of money. And I'll just take you through the example. This is age 65. Client, let's say, has a $1 million portfolio. They're age 65 male. They think they can take 7% of their money. Here's the asset allocation that they choose. This is the result that we show them. We say that, you know, 10 years later, when you're 75, you're 84% likely to be alive, 100% likelihood that, you know, your money will last at that withdrawal rate. But when you get into, you know, 20 to 30 years away, there's only an 18% chance or less that your money would have lasted at that, you know, withdrawal rate. So the next thing we do is say, look, you know, you really should be taking more like, you know, 4% of your income. No matter what you do to the asset allocation, you really have to drop the level of withdrawals to live off of your income without of your assets without running out of money. And so we say, well, hold on a second. There's a better way to do this. Okay, that's where the product comes in. So I never started talking about the product. In fact, I won't talk about it till the end. I'll say, what if I could show you with the $1 million there at age 65, let's say you wanted $50,000 a year, which is a 5% withdrawal rate, would have been a 5% withdrawal rate. If you allocate 7% to this insurance vehicle that I have, it will generate at age 85 an annual income of $50,000. Okay, so that was like 7% of your money. So with the rest of your money, the $930,000 that's left, you can now use that to exist from age, or to live from age 65 to 85. You don't have to try to make it last forever. Okay? So I just showed you a way to get immediately increase your income from 4% to 5% and not run out of money. Why wouldn't you consider that? Sold? Okay, so that's it. Okay, in conclusion, here's my conclusion. Okay, great ideas do not guarantee success. That should have said success. Okay? A winning idea is one that overcomes not only the challenges of execution, but it also has to overcome the challenges of acceptance all the way through the market chain. Finally, successful execution is about both looking inward and outward. Innovation comes in both places, okay? And if you create the future, that's what's going to bring people to you. So that's the end of my presentation, and we'll hold questions till the end. Thanks.
The final speaker is Dr. Paul Kaplan.
To catch you on.
Paul Kaplan is Vice President of Quantitative Research, and I'm sure that Dr. Kaplan doesn't need much of an introduction. But Paul himself has published a number of articles in the field of investing, asset allocation. He has won a Graham and Dodd Award of Excellence, and he has also written quite a lot on the subject of retirement income and retirement income planning. And here today, he will be talking about asset allocation with annuities for retirement income management. So please help me in welcoming.
Okay. And okay, thank you. Well, my talk, I'm going to discuss a study that I did. So I'm actually not talking about a product here. I'm talking about a study that sees how can we integrate asset allocation with the choice of buying a life annuity, as we've been discussing for much of the day. Because in practice,
if people are going to actually use these life annuities as part of their strategy, they're not likely to want to put, say, all their money into it, even though this morning we saw there are certain models that say that is the optimal allocation. But there are various trade-offs we want to take into consideration in building an asset allocation model that includes life annuities. So my first few slides are just going to review the basic problem. I'll go through them very quickly since most of this ground has been covered already, which is, you know, what's the problem we're trying to solve? The problem we're trying to solve is to die before we run out of money. That's the whole purpose of retirement income planning. And possibly we may want to leave something left over if we're concerned about having an estate as well. So there are really two different kinds of risk that are very prominent in this problem. One is market risk, as in any asset allocation problem. If we're going to invest in risky markets, how should we split our money between stocks and bonds and cash to decide how much market risk we're going to take? But we also have this longevity risk of the possibility that we might outlive the money. So how can we manage both of those together? And so any solution is going to have to address these four different questions, which is, how much income are we going to try to generate each year? How much of that are we going to annuitize with life annuities? How much are we going to, and then the money that we don't put in the life annuities, how are we going to choose to invest it? And then the final question is estate planning. How much can we plan on leaving an estate? The approach I'm going to use is one which has become pretty common, actually, in financial planning software, which is a Monte Carlo method. And this is just the basic flowchart of a very basic withdrawal model, which says I have some portfolio. Say I'm age 65, I start with $1 million, and I have some asset allocation I'm targeting. I'm going to I'm going to use my Monte Carlo model to generate some asset returns. I'm going to take some money out. And then at that point, after I've withdrawn the money, does the person die? If they do, anything left over is left for the estate. If that estate has reached the goal, then we would call that a successful outcome. If that estate has failed to reach the goal, including possibly a goal of zero, so if we ran out of money before death, then that's a failure. If the person's still alive, we rebalance the portfolio back to the asset mix. And then we continue doing that, say, typically like 1,000 times. We repeat those experiments. We simply count how many successes we had versus how many failures. And the kind of output that we typically look at then, it typically looks like this. So here we have someone who's 65 years old at the beginning of the process, starting here with $500,000. And then we run this Monte Carlo model, and we, based on these simulated outcomes, we find out, for example, in the 10th percentile, in the worst 1 out of 10 cases, there's a 10% chance that we might, say, for example, run out of money by age 86. And then, but we can look at, say, the median, which is, the 1 out of 2 chances, and then the 75th and the 90th, curves going up, which is showing not only if markets are really good over an extended period of time, not only will we have enough money for ourselves, but we'll also have plenty of money to leave to the heirs. So this is what I've outlined is a basic model without any annuities. We're going to model the asset class returns using a basic parametric model. I'll just use a standard log normal model. I've used a set of preset asset mixes. I'm not going to try to run any sort of a mean variance optimizer or any other type of optimizer. It's just a preset of mixes that varies in 5% increments from 5% stocks, 10% stocks, and so on. And in this model, for this illustration, I'm just using a constant real level of income. I'm not going to try to vary the income level, except this is in real terms. So that implicitly, if we were looking at this in a nominal terms, the income level would simply vary with the price index. Not going to look at any taxes, but I am going to look at the time horizon using a probabilistic model. That is, I'm going to use published mortality rates And what I'm going to do is I'm going to combine those mortality rates to generate the probabilities of being alive or dead at each year, and I'm going to take those probabilities against the outcomes in the model to calculate an overall probability. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to find the relationship between the withdrawal rate and the success probability. So this is just showing you, this is just a basic three asset class model, cash, bonds, and stocks. The bond and the stock portfolios themselves, within them, actually are built up from different asset classes, large cap and small cap, U.S. stocks, non-U.S. stocks, and so on. And then the bonds have within them investment grade and high yield and mortgage bond components. And this is just showing, I'm using these 21 different asset mixes varying that have no equity, always up to 98% equity. This is just showing you what the asset mixes look like. And then here's what I actually do, just a very basic Monte Carlo approach. I run 1,000 experiments, and then for each experiment at each horizon, I find the withdrawal rate that just works. So it's kind of, the simulation process is kind of this backward-looking method where I say, okay, going out 1 year out, how much could I have spent and not run out of money? All of it. Going 2 years out, how much could I have spent and not run out of money? And so on. And as I go further and further out into the out across time, I take this out to age 115. Of course, that number is going to get successively smaller and smaller and smaller in each run. And I do that for each simulated path of returns. Once I've done that, I then, at each horizon out, at 1 year out, 2 years out, 3 years out, and so forth, I simply sort them from the highest to the lowest, and that gives me a relationship between the success probability and the withdrawal rate, which is illustrated in this example. So with this portfolio, for example, that's 40% stocks, 50% bonds, and 10% cash, the blue line, which is a little bit jaggedy, is the result of that analysis of the Monte Carlo simulation. But I take that jaggedy blue line to actually represent there should be a true underlying mathematical relationship, which ought to be smooth, and that's what the purple line represents. So what this shows is that if my withdrawal rate is 4%, and this is as a percent of initial wealth, so for $500,000, it's nothing. This is an illustrative model. Okay. So if I take out a constant amount of money, which is 4% of my initial wealth each year, I'm almost guaranteed certain of never running out of money. But you can see that curve begins to decline fairly rapidly as I start getting out 6, 7, 8, 9%, and you know once you get out to those higher numbers, like at 9%, you only have a 10% chance of succeeding. And so this is where, you know, these kinds of models are used a lot so that financial advisors can talk, you know, could tell people, you know, you really shouldn't be drawing too much money out each year because you will, if you have many years possibly ahead of you, you could spend yourself broke. That means, no, in 20 years, over 20 years.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. This is one. Now, I do this curve. This is the 20-year curve. There's also a 19-year curve, an 18-year curve, and so on, and a curve that goes way out to the 115. So I generate each one of these curves, and then I combine the curves together using the mortality rates. So the mortality rates I used are from the Society of Actuaries of Transactions publication, and I simply convert those mortality rates, which report the number of deaths per 1,000 people at each age, starting from age 5 out to age 115, and I simply go through the math and convert those into probabilities. And so what I do is once I have those probabilities and I have each of the curves I just showed you at each horizon, I simply combine them and fit a smooth curve to the overall relationship between the probability of success and the withdrawal rate. this is just showing you what the mortality rates. This is like the raw data, deaths per thousand. And you can see the rates are different for men and women, with men assumed to die off faster than women do. But by age 115, everyone's dead, is the assumption. Okay, so my illustration is going to be for a 65-year-old male, and I convert those mortality rates into probabilities. You can see the mode of the distribution. The highest point is at about age 86. And so this person would have, under these assumptions, has a life expectancy that from age 65 out to about age 85, 86, so about a 20-year horizon. But I do have a probability assigned for each year. Okay, once I do the exercise I just described, then for each of my 21 asset mixes, I get a curve that gives me the withdrawal rate versus the success probability. And some people call this the rainbow chart. Each asset mix is represented by a different color, and you can see how it kind of changes. So if I wanted to recommend an asset mix strictly on the basis of success probability given a withdrawal rate, I would simply read off the top of that curve. And if I were to do that, what I would find is that the more aggressive the withdrawal rate, the higher the more aggressive the asset allocation is going to be. So this would say that if you really want to go for it and try to spend down really fast, well, that may not be a good idea, but to lessen the probability of running out of money, you would need more equity. Now, the good thing about this is that when you get into these more sensible withdrawal rates here, you can see like the 4, 5, 6%, you do get these equity allocations, which are probably more typical of what people would hold or be advised to hold in that more like 40% equity. Okay, so that's just a very basic model without any annuities. Now let's add an annuity, and I'm going to add a very specific type of annuity, the one we've been talking about most of the day, that is the life annuity, also known as the single premium immediate annuity, and that is you pay for it once, it's immediate, it's a single premium, so you buy it once, and then it's immediate, it just makes a regular payment, constant payment until death. No bells and whistles, no riders, no other types of insurance features to it. So it's very, very plain vanilla. Single premium, fixed nominal payout, no beneficiaries, a price that presumably was based upon the person's age and gender. If the person gets older, you know, the price ought to come down. And it's an irreversible decision, too. Once you annuitize the money, it's gone. And I'm also, for the purpose of this model, going to make this a one-time assumption. There are other types of models where you can allow people to defer the decision or make the decision over time. Moshe's written some of those papers. But in this illustration, it's just to illustrate the potential role that this kind of basic annuity can have an asset allocation. What we're going to do is it's a one-time purchase. So in this example, I'm going to assume that our 65-year-old male can receive $7.50 until death for every $100 that he pays for now. And the important thing is that it's nominal. Now remember, our goal is to generate real income. And I think then this is really the first presentation of the day that we're going to talk about the need to model inflation in these models. Because I need to know what the real annuity payout is. And, you know, we talked about earlier in the day about how really undeveloped this life annuity market is in the U.S. And, you know, as poor as the market is in terms of usage, most of the products out there really are nominal, and there are very few that have a. There are a few now, but there are only a few that are, say, indexed to the CPI. So we're going to simply look at the most basic kind, that it's a nominal payout, and that means in order to figure out what the real value is, we're going to have to simulate what the price index is, and divide the nominal payout by the price index each year in order to simulate what the annuity really is paying. Now, this then opens up a whole other issue, which is that how should we model inflation in these types of Monte Carlo models? Well, the literature on modeling inflation generally would suggest that there's serial correlation in inflation, that inflation is generally mean reverting, and that we should also be modeling some kind of correlation between unanticipated inflation and return. So, for example, when there's unanticipated inflation, we know that's bad for bonds. And so we would expect a negative correlation between the inflation surprise and the bond return. So I'm going to use a simple 2.5% assumption. I'm going to assume we start at inflation at 2.5% per year, and we're simply going to mean revert to 2.5% per year. And I'm going to use three simple models. One is a constant inflation model, which is probably commonly used in financial planning software, unfortunately, as you're going to see, because I think that can lead to some pretty misleading results. And we're going to use a one-leg autoregressive model and a two-leg autoregressive model to see how does this choice of model of inflation going to impact the results. And, of course, the important thing is the impact on the price index. And as you can see, with the constant inflation, the lines at the bottom, that's going to give you the most, the constant inflation is going to have the implication of, among these models, of the lowest rise in the price index. And that's why we have to be very careful about a constant inflation assumption. Okay. Because we're going to probably be underestimating the impact of inflation. And you can see that the one-leg model has the biggest impact. And this is just showing you the differences in the autocorrelation between the one and the two-leg model and the forecast volatility. So by taking my 21 different asset mixes, and I'm going to combine them with 20 different levels of annuitization, between 0 and 95%, I'm going to go through that exercise of doing the probability, withdrawal rate probability curve to all 420 cases. And what I'm going to then do is see how these, what the impact of annuitization is going to have on the results. So here's a typical type of result, and this is the most colorful slide I have. What this shows is that as I'm varying the annuity purchase on the vertical axis between 0 and 95%, and I'm varying the equity allocation on the horizontal axis between 0 and 98%, in mostly in 5% increments. So if I had no annuities available at all, I'd be getting back to my initial model, where the highest probability without annuities is about 93%, and I put 40% in equities. But if I have annuities available, even though they're nominal annuities and it's a one-time decision, if I put 70% of my money in that nominal annuity and 70% of the remaining balance in equities, I can increase the success probability up here by a little over 2%. And on this chart, each of these regions represents an area of ever and higher probability. So the top of the mountain is that inner blue, light blue one, where the optimum occurs. And the colors represent the third dimension. So the two dimensions drawn are the annuitization and the how much in equities on the remaining balance, and then the color represents the success probability. Okay, well, putting all this together then, looking at these different models, I have the blue line, the bottom blue line, so just the repetition of the one I had before, and now I add the annuitization. And notice what say constant inflation would imply. You can just use this annuity to eliminate most of the risk at much higher levels of withdrawal. Whereas you get a much more conservative answer with the one-leg inflation model, inflation is the most volatile under that model, and the implication is that therefore the success probability is less because you're facing more inflation risk. So this is illustrating the importance of modeling inflation risk. Now the one other thing I did here was I said, well, let's suppose I also wanted to look at the possibility of leaving a state. So I'm going to measure under each of these simulations the median estate value. So when there is an estate, what's the what's the 50th percentile of the estate value, simulated estate values? And I also would argue that it could also, in a sense, be used as a measure of potential future spending, because what might happen is if the market does really well, I can either leave a bigger estate, or down the road I can decide, well, I've got more money, so I can spend more. And so this is a graph of the probability of failure versus the median estate for all 420 of my combinations. And you can see there's kind of an efficient frontier out there, that kind of outer rim. So the first part of the curve is when the probability of failure here is the lowest and the median estate value is the highest, then you don't use the annuities. But once you start using the annuities, you can extend this curve more to the left. And so with the annuities, you're going to get a better trade-off between failure probability and median estate. Okay. And then this is a graph showing, if you think about the life annuities as a third asset class, then this is kind of showing you an efficient frontier. Based on that previous diagram, this is a kind of efficient frontier that shows you that, not in terms of risk and return, but rather in terms of just the asset allocation itself. And you can see this kind of forms a line down the middle here, 0% equities down to 70% equities here, that point of the highest probability of success. And then this is just showing you the same thing using this kind of chart. Okay, so I'll conclude my comments here.
Well, in effect, what we've done is we've priced out every possible combination of purchase date and start date in advance. Right. There's very little anti-selection because of the death benefit. Right. Because somebody would have died, I'm going to give them their money back anyway. With right, the retirement income, they don't have a choice. So, right, exactly. Good question. There's a lot of education that has to go on. We've tried two different approaches. One that goes into a lot of, detail about the education, and that typically doesn't seem to work well, only because, all you need to do is raise the awareness. So you have to say, how much time and effort do I want to spend raising awareness? That can be awareness raising can be done very easily. All they want are tools that help them to tell a story, an effective story, a real story that will resonate with their clients. So, you have to have a disturbing element there that says, effectively, look, you can run out of money. You're not trying to scare people to death. You're just trying to educate them on the facts, but very crisply. And then secondly, once you've created that disturbance, the agent then has to have solutions. Okay, well, what are you going to do about this? And the solutions have to be, again, you know, they can't spend 2 to 3 hours with a client, you know, educating them on every possible issue. They have to say, look, here's some ways that you can do this. And we're still going through a learning process here. Again, it's, you know, I said, you know, here's the genesis of a successful idea. I can't tell you that it's been successful yet. So the jury's still out, but there's a lot of interest. And bottom line is that what we're seeing is that the reps are basically saying, give me some tools that I can help to explain this. You know, educate me, bring me up to speed very quickly, and let me do the same for the client.
We are in the process of developing tools for our advisors. Yeah, we'll be addressing a number of those issues. Well,
the lesson of economics makes the point that with the web availability of insurance, term insurance quotes, it's gone way down the price of insurance.
Okay.
Two part question. Number one, are different mistakes. Are there any antitrust implications? Do you have to keep a Chinese wall between
the first question is essentially who's allowed to see the quotes, and each of the companies can see the market in terms of advisors in the United States. The advisor is only allowed to see those companies that he's licensed with.
One company can't see the other company's data, correct?
A company can see the other company's data. This is essentially publicly available information that we're making it a little bit easier to get.
Not the algorithm.
But not the algorithm. Oh, no, the algorithm. No, the algorithm is confidential. No one sees the algorithm.
And things
having
an effect on price?
I believe it should have an effect on price. That is going to be subject to a study that IFIT is going to start working on.
Maybe I can add a little bit of context there. We actually use Lowell's Exchange. MetLife participates in that. And I can tell you for a fact that, you know, when we looked at the other companies', you know, offerings, in order to be competitive within the particular distributors that we wanted to show our prices to, we certainly attempted to, you know, undercut the other providers' prices in order to generate some additional market share.
The initial presentation is exactly the same, and then you're allowed to click on the company that you're most interested in, and you see the company's presentation, which is the same illustration that you would get from the company software.
No, that was okay. The question was whether regulation prevented the payouts from extending beyond 70.5.
The start date.
The issue there was the tax regulations, which basically subscribe or require that a minimum amount be distributed of the customer's implied value starting at age 70 and a half.
Was that Canada or U.S.?
That was the U.S. I'm not familiar with the Canadian requirements.
69.
Age 69?
So in other words, the end of phrase you had in the upgrade of 85 turned out not to be possible.
No, only for those prescribed, only if you have an IRA. If you take
right.
the money of the tax base, you can start whenever you want. It's only if you have anybody with an IRA.
Correct. The 70 and a half limitation applied only for qualified funds. That was by our self-imposed design constraint given the tax requirements. So we could have said, you know, you could take it at 85, but then at age 70 and a half, we'll have to find some way to tell you what the implied value is that you have to distribute from some of your qualified funds. You can't get it from here because there's no cash here. The concern we had was it was possible that client could come back and say, you know what, I have no more qualified funds anywhere to take this distribution from. Then we'd be stuck. Actually, I think you had that a little bit reversed.
I'm sorry, I didn't ask the question properly. I understand that the retirement, my interpretation of your version of the retirement product where you have to take it at age 70 was that was part of the one that also provided flexibility up to age 70 rather than only age 70.
Correct.
Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay, so my question is, have you had any interest or demand in the no bells or whistles version of the retirement product, similar or parallel to your age 85?
Oh, okay. So the question was, is there any demand or have we had any demand for the very cheap version of this, highly leveraged version of this concept where the income can only start at age 85? And the answer is, you know, it's not as good as I was anticipating. On the one hand, I'm able to say, look at how cheap you can get this. On the other hand, seems like consumers have an aversion for giving up money. They don't want to lose money. And even if you show them that, you know, there are analogies that they're very familiar with in terms of covering risk. For example, fire insurance. You know, you pay your premiums, and if your house doesn't burn down, you never complain that you paid the premiums. But you'll have a fit, or you'd have regrets if you didn't have the fire insurance and your house did burn down, you know. But so there are analogies where people give up money to cover risk without recourse to the cash that they gave up. And we're saying this is a very similar concept, except you have to wait for a very long time to get it. You know, hopefully you'll never need it, but, you know, you never know. You can live beyond 85. In fact, that's typically life expectancy. Half of the folks are going to live beyond 85. So
your experience with the age 85 only product has not inspired you to look at a parallel product just for retirement at age 70?
Correct. Well, actually, I should add a little bit of context here. We actually did look at that, and what we found was that having a version without a death benefit at age 70 did not provide a sufficient enough increment in the income that could be purchased over the version that had a death benefit. And again, a practical consideration. We didn't want to offer that and then have a beneficiary come back and say, well, you never showed my spouse the version that had a death benefit for me, and you know, they only got $10 a month more. You know, why'd you make them buy that?
You know?
Position.
Did your debtor have access to it at all? Or?
As far as I'm aware, okay, the question is whether debtors have access or creditors have access to your annuity, life annuity assets upon bankruptcy. And as far as I'm aware, they don't.
It's state by state. It depends on state by state.
Okay, so it's not universally protected.
So, besides all three presentations, I guess this is for all of the art. I know it's come up before, but credit risk has got to be in there. I'm sure you've probably just implicit. You don't want to frighten people buying your policies, obviously, but as a consumer, I would think about credit risk and default risk. So I just wonder, if that comes up, how do you respond?
Well, for MetLife, okay, the question is, you know, how do we respond to concerns that consumers might have about credit risk or default risk, about MetLife being around for, you know, the next 50 to 60 years. And I say it's not a new consideration, okay? With this product, it's not a new consideration. In effect, you're already subjecting yourself to the risk with an immediate annuity that starts today for the very distant payments, yeah. And the only thing we can say is you look at the MetLife ratings, you know, the public ratings, all the public financial reports. Met's, you know, one of the largest insurance companies by various measures. And there's no guarantee that we're going to be around, but, you know, they better be around for as long as I'm retired, because my pension is going to rely on it. Well, where the state guarantee funds, can those be used in presentations about the products that we sell? And the answer is that we're legally not permitted, or the representatives are not legally permitted to discuss state guarantee funds when purchasing insurance products. Now, you know, we can certainly make the reps aware that they exist, but they cannot actually include it in the presentation. They can make people aware, but they have to go do their own research. The consumer has to do their own research. Annuities are protected up to $100,000 of initial deposits, and that's actually, frankly, a lot more than I would anticipate going into a concept like this. It's not a standalone product or standalone sale. The way that, you know, we position it is as a, you know, a way to protect, just using a portion of your assets. It's a way to protect your longevity, but you keep, you know, most of your assets liquid. We also do present these products in the context of 401k plans, you know, younger folks saving for retirement. It would be hard to think of someone actually putting $100,000 into this. You know, maybe over 20 years, $5,000 a year, that's a very high rate of savings for a, you know, 25-year-old or 35-year-old. That probably wouldn't be the market for this. A very high net worth individual doesn't need annuities. You know, they have enough cash.
In response to Selim's question, you weren't able to say this, but the fact is that the state guarantee funds will cover a lot of credit risk.
Correct.
Okay. We won't tell them.
Other questions? Yes,
Jonathan. Yeah, to follow back to the color picture.
Yes.
Yeah, in the particular illustration I did, but yes, I mean, you would certainly, in order to apply this model in a more realistic setting, yeah, you would add Social Security, which has an inflation adjustment, and if the defined benefit, the person also has a defined benefit plan, which also would have, you know, could have a COLA clause, we would want to take that all into account as well. Mm-hmm. Right. What you're trying to annuitize is the gap.
Any interest from other segments of the annuity?
Well, in terms of the United States, Finetra offers some clearinghouse for variable annuities, and iPipeline offers a clearinghouse for fixed deferred annuities.
Actually, I can add a little bit more to that. Again, having worked with Lowell on, you know, these illustration capabilities, what we find, and, you know, Lowell won't shoot me for saying this, but for variable annuity, for example, if it was a deferred annuity, they're so specific to the various manufacturers, you know, I'm not sure how he would be able to cope with putting up our illustrations, which we probably spend millions of dollars on illustrations. If it's more, you know, sort of standardized, like a fixed immediate annuity, or maybe even a variable immediate annuity, we would certainly consider those, you know, to put into an exchange if Lowell were to offer it. Like the this other life annuity, the longevity annuity, that's pretty basic. Something like that, if other companies were to offer it, I'd be very interested in putting ours into an exchange like that. But if it's highly customizable or very specific to the carrier, you know, it wouldn't make sense to me to go to Lowell and say, well, could you put this up on your system? Because I don't think it would be apples to apples. Well, yeah, and there's So the question is, you know, how feasible are CPI indexed payout annuities, and how do you hedge behind them? To the point you made earlier, there were very few companies. In fact, in the U.S., I believe there was only one company that offered a CPI indexed annuity. The reason is that if the price of inflation indexing, just from the consumer standpoint, is significant. So, for example, If a non-indexed annuity paid $1,000 a month, at age 65, an inflation index annuity might cost, or might have an initial starting payment of $600 a month. It's going to be a huge discount on initial payment. Depends on the age. But they are feasible from a financial standpoint. We're currently looking at offering these at MetLife, despite the expectation that the consumer demand may not be there, to hedge them. In the U.S. Treasury bonds, there are bonds that are indexed inflation. called TIPS. And with a TIPS strategy on the investment side, plus, you know, you'd want to have some margins over treasuries by taking some default OC1 risk. That's a way to back inflation-indexed median annuities, as well as price them.
Ha 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 ha.